If you've ever ordered anything online, you know that it may take a while before it gets to the islands. That's because the vast majority of goods in Hawaii come here on a ship. But the share delivered by air has been growing steadily for almost 30 years. Hawaiian Airlines is the nation's oldest air cargo carrier. It was issued the first ever certificate for air freight back during World War II. This week, the company debuted a new fleet of inter-island cargo planes. The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty was on hand to witness the first shipment being loaded.
Honolulu is the single point of entry for all cargo coming into the state of Hawaii. That's true for ocean-going container ships and cargo airplanes. Although far more goods arrive in Hawaii via ship, air transit is playing an increasingly important role. Worldwide, ships account for more than 99% of annual cargo tonnage, but the 1% that moves by air represents 35% of the total global value.
When you're making the decision, ocean or air, if you need something there and it's going to hold up a whole crew from working, then that cost of air freight is nominal in comparison to the other costs you may incur.
That's Brad Dechter. He's the president of Dependable Hawaiian Express, an LA-based freight company that provides service to Hawaii. He says that although shipping things by air costs 2 to 3 times more than using a container ship, it still makes sense for some products.
Sometimes it's dependent on the freight and what features it has that makes it a danger to, say, not ship it air. Drugs that can't really take the atmosphere in a container, actual blood in a refrigerated box where there's a supply needed for a specific hospital. Flowers is another. We handle a lot of things that are done for contractors that are on a schedule, and somebody makes a mistake, and the next thing they know, they're going to have a crew of 10 people waiting for this one piece. So it's going to be cargo that, in a lot of cases, is subject to spoilage, or it's subject to a specific deadline to get there. Otherwise, Young Brothers is a lot less expensive.
According to the Hawaii Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, the use of air freight services coming into Hawaii has increased by almost 3% per year since 1990. For inter-island deliveries, the annual growth has been almost 5%. That growth in the inter-island market has led Hawaiian Airlines to expand its cargo capacity. In 2016, Hawaiian accounted for just 6% of the total inter-island cargo by volume, putting it behind Aloha Air, Transair, and UPS. A big reason for being in fourth place was that Hawaiian Airlines did not have dedicated cargo planes for inter-island routes. President and CEO Peter Ingram sees the new fleet as part of the airline's long-term strategy.
We've been expanding the business in a variety of ways, and our cargo business has been growing really rapidly over the last several years. But we realize that, you know, we've got our wide-body aircraft that can connect cargo between Asia and Australia and the mainland with Hawaii. But our service to the neighbor islands was somewhat limited by the belly capacity on our passenger 717. So what this operation does is allows us to ship that containerized larger freight to the neighbor islands, connecting it off of our long-haul flights, but also serving the needs of shippers here in the islands, whether it's people who are shipping big shipments of produce or fish traveling between the islands. There's all sorts of different shippers that have needs for larger freight operations.
And where do you see it? What do you see as the role of air cargo transport versus, say, an ocean-going container ship?
Yeah, so air cargo is typically not going to be the lowest cost transportation. So what air cargo tends to be responsible for is a high value or perishable shipment. So a lot of times you will see electronics where there's a low space but high value. The shippers don't want to maintain any more inventory than they have to because of how expensive it is. So they want it delivered just in time. And then perishables are obviously a lower value, denser product, but you've got to get it from farm to table. And if that involves a shipment, you just don't have the time sometimes to put that on a ship and have it get there. So those are the types of things that are sort of normal shipments for us.
And without giving away the secret sauce, what kind of market factors do you look at when you were launching this business, when you decided that there was room in the local market for air cargo for you to move into?
Well, you know, we deal with a lot of people who are shipping in different elements of the state, either through our 717s or on our long-haul flights. So we've got a pretty good sense of what the needs are in the marketplace. A lot of it came down to really just listening to our cargo customers and hearing about their needs. And we started doing the math on that and decided that there was a good opportunity and we should go ahead and pursue it.
And where do you see the business going over the next, you know, next year, 2 years, 5 years?
Well, I'd like to see us continue to grow and expand. Obviously, we're starting with two markets right now, serving a round trip between Honolulu and Hilo every night and a round trip Honolulu to Lihue every night. We certainly are looking to add the other two big airports in the state in Kona and Kahului early next year as we get more aircraft. And I think then we'll just take it from there and see how the market grows. And if we are successful in growing the business, we'd like to add more airplanes and add more service.
Overseeing that growth will be the job of Brent Overbeek. His team manages Hawaiian Air's cargo operation. He says that understanding the market is key.
Obviously, a lot of commodities move by air within the state. We felt like we had a lot of opportunities to kind of grow within that. And so, like I mentioned, we've done a really nice job of growing our business in the bellies of our 717s flying around the state. But we really felt to take that next step forward, we needed to be able to offer containerized freight. And so that had tangible benefits here in terms of the local community and being able to serve that, serve some of our big partners, you know, like FedEx, Big Island Fish. A variety of customers that really want to do business in terms of containerized freight, as well as a variety of other customers. And then having one-stop shopping of being able to offer express service on the 717s, being able to offer long-haul service in terms of stuff overseas or connecting through here to our long-haul services, really putting all that together really justified the business case to make this investment.
And I would think that the rise in popularity of online shopping has really increased the demand for air cargo services.
Yeah, so it is a changing dynamic of how things used to get shipped in terms of things through the postal service and big bulk shopping that came in. Some of that would be more apt to travel via ship than via air. And with online shopping, it certainly has changed the how we ship and how customers come to expect those products.
So just give us a little overview. How much cargo are you going to be moving now? What's your, you know, projected growth for the next year or two?
Yeah, so with the dedicated freighters, we've got two flights a night right now. We've got a nightly flight to Lihue and a nightly flight to Hilo. Those can carry up to 18,000 pounds of cargo each day or 5 days a week when we have the operation running. We don't run a couple days a week because the freighter demand isn't there. So we'll have that in the first part of next year. We'll have an additional services starting. We'll be able to start services to Kona and to Kahului, and we're looking forward to be able to grow that. So that's in terms of the dedicated freighter service. In the context of the mainline business, we continue to grow. Obviously, the world economy is doing quite well, and that's usually a pretty good proxy for what's going on in the cargo business. So we've been able to grow that business in kind of low double digits to mid double digits, 10-15% over the last couple quarters, and we certainly see that continuing going forward.
Speaking of the global economy, there are, you know, recessions happen. How susceptible is the air cargo business locally to either a national or a global recession?
So I think it's pretty recession-proof in terms of importing goods into Hawaii. I mean, we have needs day-to-day in terms of our needs here as residents and citizens of Hawaii. And so that piece is probably a bit more stable. Transiting business from Asia to the mainland is probably a little bit more susceptible to the global economy. But overall, we've got a pretty strong, solid foundation in terms of being able to run the business successfully.
Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
The inaugural flights of the new cargo service were used to deliver construction tools and home furnishings to hard-hit communities on Kauai and Hawaii Island. And a quick correction, earlier this morning on HBR Headlines, we mentioned that those supplies were donated by Oahu-based retailer City Mill. They were actually purchased by Hawaiian Airlines from City Mill at a discount. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's quiz, we delve into our state's extensive list of Hollywood film productions to test movie buffs out there. The title we're focused on is the action comedy Tropic Thunder. Conceived by actor Ben Stiller while filming Empire of the Sun, the idea simmered for almost two decades before it got the green light in 2006. It filmed on the Garden Isle in 2007 and premiered at the Mann Village Theater in Westwood, California on August 13, 2008. Now, through the magic of cinema, Tropic Thunder turned Kauai's dense foliage into the jungles of Vietnam. Mostly filmed in the Wailua Falls area, other locales that made it into the movie included Hanalei, Kauai Ranch, and Guavakai property, and the Kauai Sands Hotel. For today's quiz, can you tell us who's credited for writing the story that Tropic Thunder's screenplay was based on? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm taiko artist Kenny Endo. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you live on Oahu, you may have received a survey in the mail recently. It's part of an effort by the city to get feedback on the development plan for the urban core. The Department of Planning and Permitting just kicked off a week's worth of pop-up outreach events and plans more over the next year. There's also an online survey, too. We sat down with Kathy Sokugawa, the acting director of the city's Department of Planning and Permitting, to understand what's at stake.
The Primary Urban Center, or as we plan is fond to use the acronym PUC, development plan is a long-range regional plan mostly centered around land use for the area stretching from Kahala to Pearl City. So this is what we call the primary urban center, what other people know as urban Honolulu. And the plan goes out for at least 25 years and talking about in general terms what the land use pattern for the development should look like in the coming 2.5 decades. What would be the general areas of employment? What are the major public facilities that should be upgraded or constructed? How are we going to do with some of the major issues of the day, such as climate change and affordable housing?
So it's really a blueprint for growth.
Well, growth, and also to make sure that we keep what we feel is important, our natural resources, our healthy shoreline and ocean qualities, that sort of thing. We're not going to forget keeping what we need to keep.
Talk about the process and the message that you're trying to get out to the public.
We're wholeheartedly trying to engage as many people and many stakeholder groups as possible. For example, we are already completed a mail-in survey, so we have a representation of everybody in the community. As you know, sometimes we get a fairly narrow segment of the population who comes out to meetings. Not that they're not important, but we wanted to make sure that everybody had a piece of the puzzle in terms of what the community is thinking are the important issues and concerns of the day for the primary urban center. So we've engaged for a representative or scientific survey so that we have a good representation of all of our residents. But we're also availing ourselves or the public to a website which will have a dynamic set of white papers, information, tell us what you think, They will also be able to do the survey as well. And we are also having, as we said, we've scheduled 8 what we call pop-ups or short opportunities for the public to engage us, and we go to where they are. So we've gone to places as a variety as places as Fort Street Mall during the lunch hour, Pearl City Shopping Center, so different places where people are already gathering, and so we can find out from your average, you know, resident what's on their mind in terms of future growth for the primary urban center. We will also have fall speaker events. We've done some white paper on major issues such as housing, climate change, general population and growth. And then we hopefully will have a draft revision of the current plan, because there is one already adopted, sometime next year.
Okay, and this is important because we're also coming into the urban core with rail.
Yes, yes. So it's ideal. We've done, as you may know, 8 TOD plans. They center around what growth should look like as the rail comes into these host neighborhoods, as you will. There are 8 plans. We have covered 18 of the 20 stations, rail stations. So we have plans about growth and what should be the priority for growth in each of those stations, ranging from Pearl City, again, to Alamoana Shopping Center Station. So they will dovetail very nicely with the overall regional plan for the area, which is the PUCDP.
So the mail-out surveys, have you already sent those out?
Yes. And so we're now collating those results, and we had an amazing result. Normally people are satisfied with a 5 or 10% return on a mail order questionnaire, but we've gotten over 25% return, so we have over 1,000 results. So that's quite amazing. We're very happy about that, which means that people are interested in the future of their communities.
Right, and you're really just trying to get that feedback and get a broad segment of the community to make sure that people say, oh, I didn't know about this.
Correct. So, and again, it you know, in this day and age, we are spending a lot of time with a vibrant, energizing website that will be dynamic and continue to update people on how the project is going along.
So if you happen to get one of these mail-out surveys, and let's say in over the next year you think of something else, how do you get that feedback across?
We're also developing a very robust email list as well as address list, so we will keep people informed that way. I'm not sure that we have budgeted enough money, because they're fairly costly to do a representative survey, but certainly as we get this list of people who already are self-committing to being interested in this project, that we will be tapping them through the mailing list.
You also plan to go out to the neighborhood boards. So do you expect the neighborhood boards to come up with, like, positions on some of these issues?
Certainly. We will keep them very much involved and notify them of the progress. It's been a little difficult. We were trying to get neighborhood board-specific venues, but that seemed to be a little more challenging. We have about 15 neighborhood boards in this region, so it's a very diverse group. So we're just engaging them as part of the general public, but we are keeping them definitely on our mailing list. They are already on our mailing list.
So as far as the plan for rail, and I know there's talk about the sea rise level and how that might affect the rail project.
The sea level rise, the climate change issue, is more than just how does it impact the rail system. And so we will be taking a broader look at it. As you know, if you've seen any of the maps the scientists have started to share with the general public, Waikiki will be severely challenged in the next coming decades, as well as downtown. The harbor areas, there will always be a larger context for discussions on sea level rise. And the other aspect of climate change, which people sometimes put on a secondary level, would be the increased or the differences in how our rain and our storm events are going to occur. It's been discussed that there may be less rainfall, but they will be coming in larger, more severe storms, which means our drainage supply and our drainage system will have to adjust to those things. Sea level rise is also beginning to intrude into our own drainage system, so you have salt water infusing upstream, so as it were. And so those things we have to discuss, even if you're not on the shoreline.
We did talk to the Army Corps of Engineers about the Alawai project, and I know they said that they got money included in the federal budget for a proposed flood control plan that involved putting up walls along the Alawai to protect not just Waikiki, but also the community on the other side of Kapi'olani Boulevard, which they pointed out was actually lower than the Waikiki side. And one point that they brought up was, you know, the money's going toward the capacity building of the Alawai. Whether the city and state want to talk about raising Alawai Boulevard and the surrounding park area is, you know, another question.
Yes, and so the primary urban center will, part of the job is to collect all of these separate initiatives and then put them into a regional context altogether and see if we can come up with a cohesive strategy for the future. So it's not just about rail. It's not just about Alawai future. It's looking at the whole area holistically.
We talk about the housing crunch and there's the concern about the density with the monster houses and all of that. But is that all then a part of this plan, this blueprint?
I think in general terms, it's not going to be so detailed as to set up a policy, I don't think, for monster homes. But the whole issue of infill housing and the opportunities are tremendous in the primary urban center to do that. And based on the general plan, we should be adding more housing to the primary urban center. So how do we do that? That's one of the issues that we will be tackling in this project.
And there has been talk about building up along the rail route.
Amazingly, communities are ready for that. They are not opposing, on a NIMBY basis, additional housing in their neighborhoods. They just want it done right. So that's very gratifying. We've worked with all these communities to prepare them for the possible opportunities and impacts that the rail might bring to them. And I believe that we're beginning to have a firm foundation on looking at new growth in these rail station areas.
Now, you mentioned NIMBYs, you know, not in my backyard, folks, uh-huh. But I was also reading about, I think, YIMBYs, like, yes, in my backyard. There are folks that are going out and actually advocating for development in their areas.
Yes, that's great. And I think it's very gratifying as city planners to see communities take responsibility on their own initiative, not expect government to do all the take on the heavy load, but also they're willing to share in that load, and that's very gratifying. So if I could segue a little bit as an example, we just found out that Chinatown merchants are beginning to take a more of an interest in the homeless situation just as merchants and not expecting government to do everything, but they're also doing their part in terms of telling the homeless where they can and cannot begin to camp and tent out in their community. So I think that's great.
That was Kathy Sokugawa, head of the Honolulu's Department of Planning and Permitting. I'll look for links to find out more about the plans at the Conversations Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providing auto insurance since 1911, committed to delivering personal attention and expert advice. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Now, most schools are back in session, and Suvan Lee has a story about what public schools have been doing to recruit new teachers. Morning, Suvan.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. And, you know, your story, you've got a really interesting tidbit about the change in the marketing strategy for DOE.
Yeah. So the DOE, as we know, they go on these mainland recruitment trips, right, every spring to find new teachers. Now, what intrigued me about their new shift in strategy is actually bringing along current principals on these trips. You would think that, having someone kind of at the school day to day would be a good sort of person to convey to these candidates what teaching at that school would actually be like. So that's what they're kind of tapping into right now.
So how long have they been doing this?
So some principals have been going to the mainland to talk to candidates, but I think they're just kind of going on a more recent push within the last year or two to sort of encourage more principals, especially those in remote areas or on neighbor islands, to go on these recruitment trips to talk to candidates.
That's a great idea because really you get a personal connection with the principal that, you know, you might be working under.
That's right. And I think it really sort of goes towards this idea of relationship building. The DOE, as with many other education systems in the country, you know, is facing a teacher shortage. So where to find these new teachers? And I think more than that, it's how to keep these new teachers. So when I talk to these principals who've been on these trips, they tell me about, you know, connecting with these young education grads, and those grads in turn tell me that, you know, they want to go work for that particular school because they've had conversations with these specific principals. They know what it's like. They know what the community's like ahead of time. So when they get here, you know, it's not so stark in terms of the contrast.
Right. And some of these teachers are coming from, you know, far-flung areas. I know in your story you mentioned Marist College, which is in upstate New York. It's a small school. And then they come out and are maybe planted, you know, somewhere on the west side, which is very different.
Right. Well, with Marist College, they are actually building a relationship with Makaha Elementary, which is in Waianae. So there's actually a bit of a relationship there to begin with. But sure, other mainland recruits who might not necessarily be talking to current principals on these trips, but just a DOE recruiter, for instance, might get to Hawaii and not even know where they're going. That's one issue. The second is if they do get placed, they could very well be placed somewhere outside of urban Honolulu. And as we all know, you know, living on some of these outskirts of town, especially when you're not from here, it's not easy. There's a lot of adjustments. And so I think what we're seeing that's new here is just active outreach and a specific idea of where these teachers are going to go before they get here.
And they're also trying to sweeten the pot, right? There are some incentives.
That's right. The DOE has always offered a location incentive for certified teachers. What's new this year is those teachers who participated in a spring 2018 off-island recruitment trip, completed their teacher certification in Hawaii, and offered a accepted a job for this school year, I believe get an additional $3,000 or so.
Well, that's great. Well, we appreciate you digging this information up. It certainly gives us a different viewpoint on what's happening to recruit teachers and the efforts to keep them, to retain them. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was reporter Sue Von Lee with today's Reality Check. To read her full story about teacher recruitment, visit civilbeat.org.
HPR supporters have watched Danny Carvalho grow from teenage slack key prodigy to band leader, producer, and working musician. He has recently teamed with singer-songwriter and hula dancer Nani Edgar to form Kailua Moon. Catch them and their fresh sound in the Atherton on Saturday the 25th. Call HPR during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Speak Mandarin, Cantonese, or Arabic? Have a sense of adventure? Well, the FBI may be interested in having a conversation with you. The agency is making a big push to recruit linguists on a contract basis. FBI Special Agent Jason White dropped by our studios to talk about the opportunities to support the law enforcement mission.
We are doing a contract language hiring initiative, not just Arabic or Mandarin, but all languages. We're looking for people with language proficiencies that can help with translations, help during interviews, and also to provide information about culture for different regions where we have a need. Pretty much all languages, Tagalog, you know, we've had needs for Russian, various languages. So if anyone has a language capabilities, we'd love to have them apply.
So what's involved in the process? Maybe we should start out, like, you can't apply for this job if, like, what, you have a criminal history, or how does that work?
There's minimum qualifications. You got to be 18 years old, be a U.S. citizen, lived in the U.S. For at least 3 of the last 5 years, unless you're working for a government or a federal government, U.S. government, OCONUS somewhere. You got to be able to obtain a top secret security clearance, pass a background investigation, the language proficiency test. You'll have to go through that process as well. Polygraph, and be available to work about at least 20 hours a week. Most of our language folks work a full 40-hour week, but you have to work a minimum of 20. Some of the disqualifiers, if you're not a U.S. citizen, I mentioned you have to be a U.S. citizen. That could also be a naturalized. You don't have to be native-born. You cannot be convicted of a felony or violated the FBI drug policy. Those type of things are automatic disqualifiers.
Okay, and then what's the process? Like, how long does it take to go from when you actually, you know, submit your application to when you hear back?
Well, unfortunately, it's not a quick process. The Bureau, all these things takes take time. The language proficiency test that an individual will take is, I think, it's a 5-part testing that ranges from reading, 2 different types of oral tests, listening, and translation. So that testing takes a process. The background investigation, we're going to go out and talk to your neighbors, your past jobs you've had. If you've lived internationally, that could kind of slow it down a little bit, because we do reach out to embassies and our legal teams, our legal attachés in other countries to do some background on you in those places as well. So typically 6 months to a year, could be a little longer, could be a little quicker, but you're not going to come in for an interview on Monday and be working on Friday.
Does this basically mean that you just work out of Honolulu?
Well, you'll be based out of Honolulu. I mean, we do have language folks all over the United States, actually internationally as well. But you could be based out of Honolulu, work out of the office in Kapolei. However, some of the work you'll be doing, maybe the majority of the work you'll be doing, could be coming from cases or investigations from all parts of the world. You could be sitting in Honolulu doing a transcription on a case from New York or Jacksonville or Denver, somewhere like that. But there is opportunities for travel. Our agents are conducting interviews all around the world. If they need an Arabic speaker, they need a Mandarin, Tagalog, whatever the language may be, you may be called and asked, hey, will you go to Afghanistan? Will you go to, you know, the Philippines? We need help there. So a lot of opportunities for travel.
What about languages from the Pacific Islands?
Okay, there hasn't been traditionally a huge need. I do know that we have used contract language specialists for Samoa. We've had a case from Guam. But once again, if you do have one of those language skills or capabilities, we would like to have them apply. Just so, like I had mentioned, the process takes can take a long time to complete, that if we have a need come up, we have somebody on the book, somebody we could go to. We have about 175 languages we test for, but we can test for any language. There's more than 175 languages. We will come up with a testing procedure or somebody that is fluent in that language to make sure that, you know, people go through the proper testing. But there's always a need, or I guess the potential for a need. We call them contract linguists, and the difference is they're not a full-time employee. They don't get, you know, employee benefits. They come in, they get a workspace, they work in FBI space, they get an hourly wage. There is potential, though, for those people to convert into full-time FBI employees. And it seems like there's a need, and each year the contract gets renegotiated and so forth. So there is a potential for a permanent full-time position, but the majority of our language folks start out as a contract.
And what is the pay range?
I think it's around $30 to $40 an hour. We require them to work at least 20 hours because it really doesn't benefit us if somebody says, oh, I just want to work 2 hours a week. So we require them to work at least 20, but like I said, the majority of the ones we have are 40-hour-a-week contract.
They do you have a large pool?
A pretty good-sized pool, but there's always a need. I mean, language, I mean, the cases that we work are so diverse, and that's one of the reasons where this initiative is kind of targeting here in Hawaii, because we're in a diverse environment with people and from all walks of life and all cultures. So it's, swimming in a big pool of possibilities here.
Is there a large rejection rate?
You know what? I can't really speak on that, but there are people that do fall out for a variety of reasons. You know, we do, as I had mentioned, a background, criminal history, finances. We're looking at all that, past employment history. I mean, we need to make sure we're hiring people that come in, they honest, trustworthy, dependable, reliable, accountable. The U.S. government does not discriminate on age or anything like that, so the door is open. The Bureau, I mean, we have about 37,000 around employees worldwide. About a third of those are special agents. That's two-thirds for other positions. We call them professional support positions. They range from, intelligence analysts, surveillance specialists. We have forensic accountants. We have jobs in the STEM field. Biologists that work in our lab in Northern Virginia. All our evidence that needs to be processed will go to our lab in Virginia. There we got scientists doing DNA testing, forensic testing, hair, blood, whatever, a variety of different things. We have computer specialists. They do all of our electronic data, computer analysis, so forth. IT specialists, just regular information technology folks that keep our databases and our systems up and running. For college students, while they're pursuing their degree, we have an honors intern program where these students, they can apply. I think it's about a 10-week program during the summer. They come in and they work in an FBI office. They kind of move around, work in all different facets of the office. They get a salary experience, and a lot of times they come back next summer, and eventually once they graduate, get hired on, and one of the positions we have, but really opens the door to a lot of different possibilities for these kids.
And what about moving around?
The Bureau, it does have a policy, but typically that only applies to the special agent position. I think it will be needs of the Bureau through all fields, but predominantly the agent position. I've been in Hawaii probably about, as an agent, maybe about 17 years or so, so I've been out here a little while. Once you get to a point you want to stay, you can kind of stay, especially for the support positions, like we mentioned, the language and so forth. The unique thing about that program is you can be in Hawaii, and they just send you the information, the audio files or whatever, and you work from here. But if you did want to transfer, some of these positions, like I had mentioned, or the biologists and so forth, we don't have a lab in Hawaii, so you get hired as a biologist or a scientist, you're probably going to work in the lab in Virginia.
We've been chatting with Honolulu Special Agent Jason White about a push to hire contract linguists for the FBI. For more information about the program, you can check our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Chris Tokumaru from the United States Department of Agriculture. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the show, we quizzed you on the action comedy Tropic Thunder, conceived by actor Ben Stiller while filming Empire of the Sun. The idea took some time to get off the ground. According to cinematographer John Toll, Kauai was chosen for filming due in large part because the island's dense foliage, variety of terrain, and the weather were very similar to Vietnam. Now, filming took over 13 weeks to complete, so the cast and crew members were housed at a couple of resort quest and rental properties. Base camp was the empty lot next to Kintaro's, lined by trailers. Local moviegoers may have been paying more attention to the scenery than the plot line, but diehard fans remember that the screenplay was based on a story written by Ben Stiller and Justin Theroux. And congratulations to Kyle Yoshida from Pearl City. You got it right. That's today's quiz, and if you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Georgia Skinner from Creative Industries DBED. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
The islands of the Philippines offer a store of rich fables and folklore. Here's a sample of what's in store at Honolulu Theater for Youth's season opener, Our Stories with Filipino Folk Tales and Fables.
The creation of the Philippine Islands.
Once upon a time,
there was only one single very, very large piece of land, sandwiched between a very great sky
and a very great sea.
In this time, a big prehistoric bird grew tired of flying around the same land for millions of years.
That's just a snippet of the show and what's to come. Creator and director Alvin Chan shares with us what was involved in the process of putting the show together, considering the nuances of a culture rich with stories across so many dialects.
And when I started doing research, just looking for stories, children's stories from the Philippines, I started to find a lot of really interesting just-so stories. Like, oh, this is how the creation of the Philippine Islands happened. Or this is how the sun, the moon, and the stars were created. And they were just so stories that were so interesting and different from any other ones that I've heard that are Western style, that I thought, why don't we just make a big collaboration of all these different stories and turn it into one celebration of Filipino culture.
And so what was it like choosing, you know, one from each area?
It was hard because there's so many good ones. And then there's also a lot of scary ones. In the Philippines, there's a lot of different mythological deities, and there's a lot of different like giants and vampires and sea serpents. So I definitely wanted to find ones that were family friendly and good for kids from K through five. And I settled on the ones that I thought sent the right message. Like a lot of their fables tell messages of, oh, respect your elders, or don't pick a fight against a thing that you can't beat, like the ocean. Never turn your back on the ocean. And there's other fairy tales that are famous. There's a famous one called The Monkey and the Turtle. And that's just about like not being selfish and greedy to your friends. As I was researching all the different stories, at first I wasn't thinking about which island the stories might have come from. I was just like, oh, this story's cool, this story's cool. And then when I put it together, we had some Filipino guests come and see and listen to a run through, and they're like, "Oh, which islands are these from?" And that's when I realized, "Oh my goodness, the Philippines is kind of like China in that way."
Yeah.
Like, yes, Tagalog is the national language, but there's so many different dialects from all the different islands. And so, yeah, we do have stories from Ilocos. We have Tagalog stories. We have Visayan stories. We have one from the Igorot mountain people. Yeah, all over the Philippines. And that, I think, is one of the most interesting things about the show, is that it has contact with all the different areas in the Philippines.
And so what was that like, kind of reaching out to the resources here in our community?
It was wonderful. I've never had so much support from different people, from teachers, from the head of the Filipino club at Farrington, to choreographers, dance choreographers and teachers at UH, to Filipino community groups all around the island, all willing to lend a hand and give culture advice.
What was it like as far as selecting the actors?
Well, I've been lucky enough. A lot of the actors in our company, you know, are Filipino or part Filipino.
Oh, interesting.
And most interesting for this production, I was contacted by a kid who was born in the Philippines and grew up locally and went to college in Seattle. One of my actors, Christian, actually contacted us from Seattle saying, "Hey, I hear you're doing a Filipino show, and I'd love to be in a show that, you know, is about my culture and my background." So we were like, "Yes, let's hire you." And I flew him back for the summer, and he's going to be performing with us and then going back to Seattle.
Okay, and so then talk about some of the things that our listeners might hear or see.
You'll be seeing a lot of Filipino folk dance and hearing a lot of Filipino folk music, from tinikling with the bamboo poles clacking together to a dance called Pandango Sa Ilaw, which is with candles on their heads and in their hands, and a lot of music from Filipino gongs to a lot of guitar, and you'll be seeing just a lot of colorful costume changes going all over the place.
So, what was it like for some of the actors? You know, maybe because maybe you focused on a part of the Filipino culture that they weren't aware of.
One of my actors, Junior Tesoro, who's like the oldest longstanding actor at HTY, about 20 years or so, we did a reading and he's like, "Wow, I learned more about my culture in this 55-minute reading than I have in years." And I think that was eye-opening for me too, because a lot of people say, "Oh, we've never heard these stories because we're growing up learning about Snow White and Hansel and Gretel." And so it's nice to have stories that are from my own culture. Be doing a small performance at the Filipino Community Center on the 26th. It's an event that's being led by the Technicklings from 3 to 6, and we're going to be a part of that. And we've also got in touch with Filipino women from universities group. They are going to be helping cater our opening night with awesome Filipino food.
Oh, you have to.
Mm-hmm.
So this has probably been kind of an interesting deep dive for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, my forte has been more in the Japanese and Chinese theater realm. And most of my studies have been in traditional Chinese and Japanese theater, like Kabuki and Beijing opera, Jingju. And so going into the Filipino culture for me has been very educational because I know very little about it. And it's just been a lot more research, but a lot more fun and eye-opening.
So is there any one takeaway that you might want to share just in your journey and during the research and then, you know, tapping the community and I guess maybe watching the growth even with the actors in this production?
I think my biggest takeaway is that there are many cultural groups in Hawaii that are so important to our islands that are not necessarily always represented in entertainment, in education, in culture itself, you know, that can be glanced over, that have a lot of wonderful things to say, and that we shouldn't overlook any of them.
Kung pag-uusapay pag-ibig ang aking sadyang hahanapin ay isang lalaking makisig na ang puso'y di magtataksil. Makamit ko lamang ang langit, hahanapin ko ang hilahil dahil sa ako'y karinyosa sa pag-iliw. Ang buhay laging mamamanglaw kung di makakamtan. Ang pagsintang tunay kailanpaman ay irog, bigyan ng pag-asa. Ang tanging pagsinta ng puso'y may dusa. Ang buhay laging mamamanglaw kung di makakamtan. Ang pagsintang tunay kailanpaman ay irog, bigyan ng pag-asa. Ang tanging pagsinta ng puso'y may dusa.
That was Alvin Chan, creator and director of HTY's latest production, Filipino Folk Tales and Fables. It's Honolulu Theater for Youth's 64th season opener, on stage Friday, August 24th, and Saturdays from August 25th through September 22nd. Chan will end his run at HTY with this show, as he'll be advancing his theater studies as a Master's of Fine Arts directing student at Northwestern University this fall.
I'm Stephen Dubner. I'm the next Freakonomics Radio. If there's one thing human beings are really bad at, it's assessing risk.
My wife is terrified of snakes and mice. I mean, the thing that you should be afraid of are French fries and getting too much sun for skin cancer.
We like to think we make important decisions based on facts. Guess what? We don't. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7.
These days, businesses are just getting used to not always knowing what is going on.
We have things that are on the table that are very important. How they leave the table is the uncertainty piece that people seem to be tolerating more and more.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll try to keep up and help you do the same next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk sleep and the health problems when you don't get enough. Call in and join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. What do you think about the primary election results? Call our TalkBack line. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.